堂听 class.com。
Good evening. It is a great honor for me to share this stage with the Lord Mayor and Chief Executive of Hanover, with Mr. Young, and in a few minutes with Chancellor Kohl. I've been looking forward to this evening for a long time because I've known for many years how important CBIT is to the global information technology industry. So before I go any further, I want to thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this important forum. Now, I've given a lot of thought as to what I would say to you this evening. On the one hand, I'm here as a representative of the information technology industry on the eve of an event that is bigger by orders of magnitude than any other technology exhibit. That's quite a statement in an industry that's good at many things, especially celebrating its own creations. On the other hand, like most of you, I've spent most of my professional life as a customer of this industry. So I know that after the splash and the promises comes the harsh light of morning. And often the customer is left standing alone wondering what happened. Or as the head of one of our most important German customers put it, yours is an industry that is very good at weddings and not so good at marriages. So tonight, while I will talk about the power and the potential of information technology, I hope to temper my remarks with the perspective I had when I came to IBM 5 years ago, the perspective of a customer. Now, it's certainly easy to see why raw technology dominates these events. It's seductive, it's breathtaking, and it's penetrating every aspect of our lives. Today, there are more PCs sold annually in the world than TVs or cars. The typical luxury automobile today has 20 to 30 microprocessors in it, more computing power by far than was inside the landing craft that took the first astronauts to the moon. Last year, there were 5 times more email messages sent than the number of pieces of paper mail delivered worldwide. 2.7 trillion emails. And I got more than my share. There's another way to look at what's going on. In the mid-1970s, the first supercomputers appeared. They were capable of about 100 million calculations per second. And they cost about $1 million. Today, the laptop computer that college students carry in their backpacks is twice as fast as that first supercomputer, and it costs less than $3,000. The trend in data storage is even more impressive. In the early 80s, the standard unit of computer storage, 1 megabyte or 1 million bytes of information, cost about $100. Today, it's 10 cents. In 2 years, it will cost 2 cents. These gains are driven by continuous advances in how we pack information into smaller and smaller spaces. If the U.S. Library of Congress could shrink its collections of 17 million books by the same factor we just discussed, it could replace 800 kilometers of shelf space with less than 40 meters of space. These advances are going to continue at an accelerated rate. Microprocessors, storage, communications, memory, and all the other engines that are propelling this industry will continue to lead to products that are faster, smaller, and less expensive, just as they have for 30 years. But as we stand here today at the opening of CeBIT, we are on the threshold of a very important change in the evolution of this industry. In many ways, this industry, a very immature industry, is about to play out in its most important dimension. That's because the technology has become so powerful and so pervasive that its future impact on people and governments and all institutions will dwarf what has happened to date. I believe there are two trends that are most significant here and bear the closest watching. The first is what we call deep computing. The term is inspired by our chess-playing supercomputer, Deep Blue, which I believe many of you know competed with the grandmaster Garry Kasparov last year. Deep Blue is an amazing machine, capable of 200 million moves per second. But speed, while essential, isn't enough. After all, Deep Blue's predecessor was quite fast, but it lost to Kasparov 2 years ago. The difference the second time around was an infusion of knowledge, human chess knowledge, thousands and thousands of chess moves, games and outcomes, captured as mathematical algorithms. This is what led Deep Blue to mimic the workings of the human mind and race through millions of possible chess positions and extract the best one. And it worked rather well. But Deep Blue is emblematic of a whole class of emerging computer systems that combine ultra-fast processing with sophisticated analytical software. Today, we're applying these systems to challenges that are far more vital than chess. Let me talk about two important application areas, starting with simulation. Simulation is about replacing physical things with digital things, recreating reality inside these powerful computer systems. In the pharmaceutical industry, the ability to simulate the interaction of chemicals and do it in the computer rather than in test tubes and petri dishes can speed up by years the discovery and testing of new pharmaceuticals. Mercedes, BMW, Fiat, Volvo, Saab, all design cars today on computers. No physical mock-ups, no models. In aviation, Dassault pioneered many of these techniques, and Boeing broke new ground when it designed the 777 airplane entirely on computers. It was a very bold move, and even some of Boeing's engineers had trepidations. I had trepidations because 3 months after I joined IBM, I went out to Boeing to see my good friend Frank Schrantz, who was the CEO. And Frank said to me, since this new airplane was built on your computers, maybe you should go on the first flight. And I said, it is my wife's birthday. And he said, I didn't even tell you the date yet. Coward. Computer simulation saves time, saves money, and it gives customers a competitive advantage. And it can do more than that. Recently, the U.S. Department of Energy asked IBM to build a gigantic supercomputer to simulate nuclear weapons so that they will never have to be exploded for test purposes ever again. The second type of deep computing is what we call data mining. Some people call it business intelligence. The ability to extract insight from mountains of information and see relationships and trends that previously were not available or invisible. Banks are looking at spending patterns and other demographic data to see which customers are more profitable over the long haul. Healthcare companies are analyzing millions of patient records to find hidden indicators of disease. These tools are also helping slash the staggering cost of insurance fraud in the healthcare industry, which is a $100 billion problem in the United States alone. Insurance companies can now spot aberrant billing practices. One company in the United States has saved $38 million, having invested only $400,000 in this technology. In one instance, they found a doctor who was sending in a bill once a week for a procedure that usually was done once or twice in a lifetime. Now, sometimes the patterns and the relationships that are uncovered are truly baffling. One retail chain discovered the following correlation. For whatever reason, new fathers buy disposable baby diapers and beer on the same shopping trip. This led to many, many thoughtful ideas, not the least of which was they never discount diapers and beer on the same day. So we believe that deep computing is a trend that will have a profound effect on commerce and on society. Of course, in concept, throwing big problems at computers is not a new idea. Its roots can be traced to the very origins of the industry. The difference today is that these systems are so much more powerful and so much more affordable that they can be used by businesses and governments and institutions of all sizes. The second major development in information technology is, of course, very topical, already discussed here this evening, and that is the rise of global networks, like the internet, to create a network world, or what some call a networked economy. About 60 million people use the internet today, and the estimates are that that number will grow to 500 million and perhaps someday to a billion. Now, what are all these connected people going to do? What do they want to do? Not too long ago, people in my industry thought that the action was going to be in information dissemination, news, weather, sports scores, online magazines called e-zines. In short, consumer information. IBM has had a different view for some time. We believe the real potential of the network world is for conducting transactions of all kinds, between parties of all kinds. And in fact, that seems to be what is happening. Consider that across Europe, internet sales of about $1 billion last year are projected to reach $30 billion by the year 2001. One study says that the worldwide internet commerce activity will double in the next 6 months alone. And most of that is business-to-business transactions. We see the total market for internet commerce hitting $200 billion by the end of the century, and that's a conservative forecast. And it's not just about buying and selling. About a year ago, IBM coined the term e-business to describe all the ways that people will derive value from the net. Transactions among employees within a business to improve how products are developed, how ideas are shared, how teams are formed, how work gets done. Transactions between a business and its suppliers, its distributors, its retailers, to increase cycle time, speed, and efficiency. And the very important transactions and interactions between governments and citizens, educators and students, healthcare providers and patients. This is very exciting stuff. And the greatest changes and challenges are not in the technology. In fact, connecting to the net is relatively easy. The big challenges are in the fundamental transformation of the way things get done in the world. That's because networks are great levelers. They dissolve barriers to entry. They neutralize traditional assets like physical stores and branches. Networks dissolve the boundaries within and between companies, countries, continents, and time zones. It's not hyperbole to say that the network is quickly emerging as the largest, most dynamic, restless, sleepless marketplace of goods, services, and ideas the world has ever seen. And naturally, this comes with very profound implications. For one thing, there are already time-honored processes that govern the way things work in the world. The way we buy and sell, the way we distribute things, the way we teach, and the way we interact with each other. But I will tell you that nearly every one of those conventions is being challenged by the network world. Let me cite a few examples drawing on what we at IBM have learned from helping thousands of customers in the last year come to the net. New competitors can come out of nowhere, overnight, and not just from within your industry. One of the most contentious, fast-moving, and bare-knuckle battles waged today is, believe it or not, in book selling. The leader in this online race is Amazon.com. If you haven't heard of them, don't feel bad. 3 years ago, nobody had heard of them. They didn't exist. Their customers don't know where they exist physically, and they don't care. Amazon.com exists only in cyberspace. But with 2.5 million titles, it is nearly 15 times larger than the world's largest physical bookstore. It's open 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and they recently served their 1 millionth customer in Japan, one of 160 countries in which Amazon ships books. Until recently, they had the market to themselves. Now the traditional booksellers like Barnes & Noble in the U.S. and media firms like Bertelsmann in Europe are jumping in. Can virtual companies like Amazon.com battle against and beat these entrenched brands? Stay tuned. We don't know yet. The same kind of transformation is happening in retail banking, in car sales, in music and entertainment, in insurance. And it's not just limited to the commercial world. Public sector institutions are being buffeted by the same powerful forces. In higher education, there's a university in Canada, Athabasca University, that delivers 100% of its courses by what's called distant learning. No students on campus, no campus. All instruction is delivered online, and they have captured nearly 30% of all MBA students in Canada. Governments are using networks to transform everything, from the way they buy goods and services to the delivery of services to citizens. Singapore is putting 10,000 suppliers online, reducing costs and increasing efficiency, and by the way, its comparative advantage in Asia. When the government of Valencia in southern France starts wiring entire villages, allowing citizens to conduct online transactions with local businesses, schedule a doctor's appointment, get information from their kids' school, you know something interesting is starting to happen. And believe me, in America, when in certain states you can register your car on the internet and not have to go wait in line, I can assure you something important is happening. Trust me on this one. Now, all of us must realize this is not a spectator sport. We're not all just sitting here watching Amazon.com. Every institution and every entity must grapple with this issue at the highest levels of management. Essen-based Karstadt is one of the largest department stores in Europe. But they're making their first foray into online sales. That's not an easy decision for an enterprise with huge investments in retail space, not to mention their economic model, their corporate culture, rooted in traditional retail sales. Who made the decision for Karstadt to jump into online sales? I can assure you, it wasn't their webmaster. Increasingly, CEOs of companies, university presidents, government officials are stepping up to these issues. They're testing pilot sites, they're setting strategy, and they're answering questions like, how will this network world affect my organization? How are we threatened? But more importantly, how can I leverage this new medium for competitive advantage? The toughest, most jugular decisions that need to be made aren't which browser or which server, they're core management and policy issues. Now, this only escalates, all these issues only escalate as the network world marches on. We've already talked about the first milestone, that is, the net connecting, say, 1 billion people to perhaps 1 million e-businesses. The next milestone is what we in IBM call pervasive computing. 50 years ago, where did you find electric motors? Big factories, power plants, and they were big and expensive. Today, you might find 100 electric motors in the typical home. They're in appliances, heating, ventilation systems, the CD player, the VCR, and, if you're so fortunate, the electric toothbrush. We don't buy electric motors anymore. They come inside of all the things we use and do every day. The same thing is going to happen with computing devices. Chips are getting so small and so inexpensive, they're being embedded in everything. Cars, appliances, tools, doorknobs, clothes. Most significantly, all of these tiny intelligent devices will be interwoven in the fabric of the computing and communications network. And what will this mean for consumers and enterprises? A quick example. Think about driving down the Autobahn. Your intelligent car develops an engine problem. But instead of flashing you a warning light, it sends a message directly to the manufacturer over a wireless connection to the net. The manufacturer's systems diagnose the problem, and they transmit a fix back to the electronic complex in your car. In fact, that electronic fix is transmitted to all models of that car anywhere in the world without having to notify the owners. And that's good for the driver. It's also better for the car maker. Instant performance information captured and sent immediately into product development and manufacturing. Continuous feedback loop, continuous improvement, resulting in better cars. Good for the consumer and a competitive advantage for the business who gets there first. How can any company with tens of millions of vending machines scattered all around the world know at any point what's selling, what's not selling, how much of an item is left, or when to send a route driver to empty the coin box? A little chip in each machine could track and report on all of those items with ease. And even better, why couldn't that machine include a thermostat that told it, it's freezing today, drop the price by 10 pfennigs. It's 35 degrees, raise the price by 15 pfennigs. Soon we will see this hyper-extended network world made up of a trillion interconnected, intersecting devices. And this will intersect with the data capability I spoke of early. Pervasive computing meets deep computing. Companies and institutions will amass more data, more information than ever in history. And for the first time, they will be able to do something productive with it, turn raw data into knowledge and move that knowledge to the right people instantaneously. Personally, I believe that future leadership companies, and by the way, future leadership institutions of all kind, will be those who know how to compete and win on the basis of knowledge. Learning, adapting, and improving the vital asset we know of as information. Now, I've covered a lot of ground here very quickly. I want to show you a brief video that illustrates some of these ideas that I've talked about.
The beauty of computer technology, what has enabled this big explosion in the last 20 years, is that they are getting increasingly more powerful without getting more expensive.
Making a chip run over 1 gigahertz was somewhat like breaking the sound barrier on land. We've really found out if you work at it, there's not anything that you can't build. And we've solved enough problems now that we're going to continue to increase frequency for the next 10 years.
Our ability to manipulate information, our ability to do video and multimedia are critically dependent upon having larger and larger storage devices. Recently, we demonstrated in our laboratory world record density of 11.6 billion bits per square inch for a hard disk drive. We want to be able to continue to advance our storage capabilities when the physical limitations prevent us from extending current devices. That's why we're investigating using holograms to store information, even manipulating individual atoms.
In the information age, up to now, the Oriental culture has a disadvantage because of the difficulty in input. To do Chinese speech recognition, we need to improve recognition algorithm. Also, we need fast computers. Now both conditions are there.
I'm painfully slow in typing.
It takes so long to master the skill typing Chinese.
我带来我公司的最新产品,句号, 请在明天上午召开联席会.
It's just fast.
讨论销售合作的问题, 句号.
Only in the last few years have computers become powerful enough to do on-the-fly translation of languages. You'll be able to go onto the World Wide Web, go to any site anywhere in the world, in whatever language that particular site is written, and quickly browse and understand that information in your native language. In about the same amount of time it takes for you to receive the web page over the network, we intercept it in the server, we do the translation, and we present the new page back to you.
International travel is growing between 7 and 10% a year. We see the pressures on border control authorities and the hassle on passengers continuing to grow. We've tried to create FastGate so that it appears very much like an automated teller machine. A traveler would take a credit card and put it in the kiosk, place their hand on the biometric reader, and those two things in real time are compared with information that's been stored in a database when they enroll. Then the system lets them in.
How can I make computers more fun to use, easier to use, more like interacting with humans? We've given the computer the ability to see us and sense where we are, and now we're trying to give it the ability to understand what we're trying to say. In fact, all I need to do is talk to it and move my hands. So, for example, now I'm moving this object around just by moving my hand. Leave it there. The computer hears me and it does what I ask.
Some of the really hard problems out there require a lot of computing power. That's deep computing.
What we have learned in Deep Blue is that not only you need fast computers, deep computing power, but you need to capture human experts' knowledge and express that in terms of algorithms.
The more power you have, the smarter things you can do. And that's what's starting to happen now, is that computers have enough processing power to solve some really interesting and difficult problems.
With such a computer, you can actually simulate the physical process, what's happening in the physical world.
I think we'll tell our kids 10 years from now, you may not believe it, but computers used to be things that sat in big boxes on top of desks, and they'll look at us like we're crazy.
As things get smaller, faster, and smarter, they allow us to forget about the computer inside the device and just focus on the function of the device.
Computers will be everywhere, performing everyday tasks for people.
We won't think of them as computers anymore.
Now, I started out this evening saying I hope to represent the voice of the customer. And as we project the benefit of this network world to hundreds of millions of people, maybe even a billion, it's clear that the information technology industry has a lot of work to do. We have got to make this technology easier to use and more natural. In that video, you saw some of the things we and others are doing and working on ease of use today. We've got to reach agreement on standards for communications, for security, for software development. And I'm asking you as customers to keep the heat on this industry. Demand that we deliver open standards. Everybody's software running on everybody's hardware over everybody's network. There's another set of issues that extend beyond the information technology industry. They're public policy issues. Some have been around forever, like privacy. Some we recognize as old issues in new dimensions, like security and taxation in the global marketplace of the Internet. Resolving these issues is going to require a new level of international cooperation. And I think the nations of the European Union have set a real leadership example in preparing for the common currency, perhaps the most important change since European integration and the Treaty of Rome. IBM has been pleased to be involved in helping a number of you prepare for this, which will fundamentally alter the economic landscape and make it easier for all our companies to grow in Europe. But because the nature of the networked world is just global, it has to be global. Agreements to these critical policy issues are going to take this issue of cooperation to a new level. We're going to have global public policy. First, people must have inexpensive access to the telecommunications services they need to participate. meaning governments have to encourage competition and end monopoly structures. And the news from Europe is very encouraging recently here. It's also clear that discriminatory tax policies can stifle this very nascent, early forming economic engine. We have to ensure that electronic business is taxed the same way as the physical business world, no more, no less. And the OECD has taken on this work, and we heartily support their efforts. We also support the move to keep the internet a tariff-free zone. This will be a big fight, but it's one we have to win together. Next, security. The demands of customers for strong encryption and government's legitimate concerns about their ability to provide public safety and enforce laws don't have to be mutually exclusive. IBM is working with the U.S. government, with the European Union, and governments around the world to support an unrestricted market for encryption products that can interoperate globally. We're not anywhere near as far along on this as we need to be, but I'm confident we'll get there. We have to get there. There's too much at stake. Finally, privacy. How can we continue to strike the balance, the right balance, between respect for the individual's privacy and the benefits, on the other hand, of information flow in a connected world? The solution here must start with the private sector, not government, and a reaffirmation of a few proven principles by all businesses: that consumers get fair notice about information that is used, that is theirs, and an opportunity to control and confirm its use. And a number of companies are moving in this direction. IBM has recently adopted a global privacy policy for managing information online, and it is posted on all of our websites around the world. With global agreement and cooperation and understanding, the information technology industry, government, and our customers will go forward, I believe, and ensure that this global marketplace grows boldly, safely, and delivers on a real promise that's important to everyone. As we look ahead to the next millennium, I don't think there's any question any longer about the profound power of this technology. In an incredibly short span of time, it is developed to the point where it can we can talk about it in the same context as any of the other great technologies that have transformed our world. We're participating in the emergence of something much bigger than a new computing model, much different than just a new channel for human interaction. Information technology, and specifically network technology, represents the most powerful tool we've ever had for change. It's a new engine for economic growth, a new medium that will redefine the nature of relationships among governments and institutions and businesses of all kinds, and the people they serve now and they might serve tomorrow. This powerful tool is here for all of us today. Each of us will have to decide how we'll exploit it and how soon. But in any case, the nations, the government agencies, the public sector, and commercial institutions that do this most effectively will create enormous competitive advantage into the 21st century. Thank you very much, and I hope you have the most successful CeBIT ever.